You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Most students in Los Angeles are back to in-person classes. That's certainly a welcome relief for those who spent last year unhappily stuck at home, struggling with Zoom and isolation. But readjustment can be difficult. Many students are still feeling the effects of the tough year behind them. A national poll from the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital in Michigan found that nearly half of parents of teenagers saw a new or worsening mental health condition in their child since the beginning of the pandemic. Today, we're bringing you one student's story about how he coped through a year plus of the pandemic, juggling both academics and a full-time job as an overnight stocker at the Home Depot. Lester Solis was a junior at Belmont High School in Los Angeles when the pandemic turned his life upside down.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lester Solis. Even though I'm an adult, even though I'm not really, because I'm still a kid. I'm only 18. At times, I would see like my friends post on their Instagram that they felt lonely or that they were maybe in depression because they weren't going out or they weren't, you know, enjoying life as how we once did before the pandemic. The pandemic taught me that you got to appreciate what you have, because I remember that we went from my mom having a job to not having a job with a second. And that was pretty scary. She's the one who took care of us and who still takes care of us. I remember when my mom lost her job, I was a little scared because I said, hey, you know, like, who's going to pay the rent? You know, obviously my brother, he could pay it. He's not going to pay all of it though, because he still has his own expenses. So during the pandemic of my senior year, that's when I actually started working. I remember thinking, you know, those bills are not going to wait to be paid. You know, they might even kick you out because that's just how things are. You know, I had to work from 9 p.m. and then I'll get out of work at 6 a.m. And on top of that, I still had to go to school like around 9 a.m. Obviously, it was through a laptop, but still, you know, like I'm tired, I'm drained, and I still got to join the class. And I remember there was a point where my grade was just falling down because I was too busy trying to take care of my family, just making sure that they were okay. But my grades were literally put on the side, and I only had Wednesday and Thursday off. And if you think about it, like 2 days off for a high school student full time, that's nothing. From one moment to the other, my life went from full time high school student to full-time high school student, and you're also working a job. Yeah, I remember telling my friends, like, hey guys, like, I work from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Like, what do you guys have to complain about? I would clock in at 9, get out at 6, go home, like, eat some breakfast, probably go to like one class that was very important, which was the English one. And then the other ones I would join sometimes, but I kid you not, like, I'll be in bed like by 10 or 11 a.m. and then wake up at like 7 or 8 p.m. And I'm like, wow, I got to do this again. And that was just such a headache, you know, and it really took a toll on my mental health because I would literally close my eyes for like 5 minutes, which it really wasn't, but it felt like I closed my eyes for 5 minutes and then I wake up just to go back to the same routine, which was my job. And I hated that. I remember crying, like, that's how bad it felt. Like, I was crying and I just didn't know what to do. I cried and it sucks. When I was at work or when I was just at home doing nothing, I feel that that's where my mental health was, you know, kind of going dark because I wasn't getting that same interaction or environment that I had in school. And, you know, just being at work was a pain in the butt because there was times where I had to stay extra hours because there's just too much shipment. And, you know, it sucked because like, wow, like, I thought I was going to get out at 6, but, you know, I guess I'd say like another hour. It just feels really bad because, at least in my opinion, I feel that your last 2 years of high school should be the best because you pretty much know everybody and you're starting to become a bit more older. You're supposed to enjoy it, but I didn't enjoy it. And I know all my peers and classmates didn't enjoy it because I remember when we went back to school for like graduation, it just wasn't the same. You know, everybody had like their diplomas and everybody was, you know, happy, but just got that vibe where it wasn't really that happy because all of us were robbed 2 years of our life from high school and just our own personal life. It's just a dent in our heart. And it sucks that I was cheated and robbed 2 years of my life. And I'm just going to carry that with me wherever I go and for the rest of my life. But that also taught me a lot. If I was able to overcome that, I could overcome anything when it comes to college, because I'm at a different mindset where I feel that I could accomplish goals. I've accomplished things that, like going to work literally every day and then going to school, completing homework. That's a lot for an 18-year-old to handle. It's really a lot. But thankfully, you know, I was able to help my family at the same time. So I know they're thankful and I'm thankful as well.
That was 18-year-old Lester Solis. Today, he's a freshman at Cal State Northridge, and he's focusing solely on getting his bachelor's degree. That segment, by the way, was produced by KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo, and Danielle is here with us now to talk about what services are available in LA schools for students who went through a lot during the pandemic and who have now returned to the classroom. Hey, Danielle.
Hey there, Steve.
So how is the district helping students who went through, I mean, it was a lot of stress.
Yeah, Steve. So big picture, both LAUSD and the state of California at large are recognizing the need for student mental health support. COVID-19 relief funding plus a record $13.8 billion budget for this school year has spurred a lot of hiring at LA Unified, not only for teachers and support staff, but also for mental health professionals. That includes budgeting for a psychiatric social worker at every campus this school year, and overall, an additional 922 full-time mental health and resource navigator positions have been cleared for hiring. But that being said, a lot of those positions are still empty. Since July, LAUSD tells me that they've hired more than 200 psychiatric social workers and family resource navigators, but that's only filled 25% of the open jobs, only about a quarter. So there's still a lot of work to be done.
It sure sounds like it, Danielle. I mean, are students making use, though? I have to ask, are they making use of the resources that are available to them?
They definitely are, Steve. So for example, last year, the district set up a mental health hotline for students and other members of the educational community here in LA to call. And to date, they received more than 27,000 phone calls. And that's according to Joel Cisneros. He's the director of student mental health at LAUSD.
That sounds like a lot of need. And, you know, what kinds of need are we talking about, Danielle? I mean, what support do students most need right now?
Sure. So good news first. I know there's a lot of concern about student mental health right now, but I talked with social workers over at Monroe High School in North Hills, and they told me that many of the kids, they are starting to bounce back after 18 plus months of pandemic living. That being said, just like hiring, there is a lot of room for improvement. Students are reporting feeling anxious and depressed. There's also new issues that have cropped up that they haven't really seen before in this fashion. That includes concerns over appearances. Here's Marta Orozco, who works over at the Wellness Center at Monroe.
Some of these kids went over a year or more without seeing their friends. And naturally, during that time period, their bodies changed, overall appearance changes. They became accustomed to lounging around in pajamas or casual outfits. And then all of a sudden, they're back to seeing their peers on a daily basis. Some of my seniors have like senior portraits, homecoming activities, yearbook photos. And then they start to worry about how they may come across after such a long absence.
She says other students are also grappling with just the full readjustment to the workload that can typically come with going to school in person.
The kids have been telling me they do have more assignments, they're involved in more clubs, some of them are involved in sports, so they're juggling normal teen activities with the pandemic and also their own mental health, and it can become overwhelming sometimes.
I also spoke with Rupal Mankasarian, another social worker over at Monroe, and she said that being marooned at home meant that students didn't have a safe place to come to anymore.
For so many students, school is an escape. They're able to, you know, leave whatever stressors are occurring within their family, within their home, and go to a safe and nurturing place. And I think with the pandemic, everyone was home. And for a lot of the families we work with, home wasn't a very safe place.
Mankasarian also said that there's still a lot that they don't know about what experiences and what burden students might be carrying with them on the day-to-day, because kids stuck at home haven't been in a position to tell anyone.
For so many of these children, they don't have a space at home where they can just, you know, log on their computer and tell their therapist every difficult detail that's going on. So I think for so many families, I feel like we haven't even really heard their stories.
So job number one, Danielle, for the mental health folks is just finding out more about what students need, right? I mean, it sounds like they certainly have their hands full.
Absolutely. Every day kids are coming in and they're feeling just a whole slate of emotions and are really grappling with, of course, what they've experienced over the last 18 months. But Mancasarian also told me that at the end of the day, kids are resilient and hopefully they'll be able to persevere through this moment.
I think children and adolescents tend to adapt far better than we as adults do to begin with. And so I think they're going to make up what they've lost and they're probably going to come out stronger because of it.
Well, school is for learning, right, Danielle?
I mean, absolutely.
Kids go to school to learn, and boy, they've had to learn a lot over the past year, year and a half for sure. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo reporting for us. Danielle, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And by the way, Danielle's reporting on student mental health is part of the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2021 California Fellowship.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. You don't need me to tell you that Los Angeles is a complicated city. It is multicultural, multifaceted, sprawling, yet stacked at the same time. And each person who lives here has a unique connection to this place. Raquel Gutierrez wrote about how LA shaped their own identity in a recent personal essay for Places Journal. The prompt was how Latinos impact the built environment of Los Angeles.
And I knew I wanted to talk about the way in which queer Latinos in particularly made care spaces out of club spaces, that these venues that are typically housed in, bars and clubs were often peopled by those of us, children of Latinx immigrants, who needed to form community in order to be able to express ourselves in ways that weren't always available to us in our homes.
Here's Gutierrez reading the first section of their piece called A Concatenation of Sprawls.
I lived in Silver Lake in the late 1990s and occasionally walked a few blocks to Sunset and caught the 704 bus to Santa Monica to get to work. It was reprieve from the spiritual void of bumper to bumper. The 704 took me to a cubicle where I logged inventory at my first and only job of the first dot-com boom. This was in 1999, just before Lars Ulrich of Metallica took Napster to court, in a case that would force the music file sharing company into bankruptcy. And I was the e-commerce manager for an online record label located at the corner of Pico and Cloverfield. I got the job through friends I'd made seeing live music in the heyday of an art punk adolescence. We grew up in DIY spaces and helped each other find work in the music industry, in Burbank and Hollywood. The promo CDs, limited edition vinyl, and free concert tickets made it seem like I had struck gold. I didn't need a college degree for that job, so why was I still nervous about maybe never getting one? Adulthood snuck up on me. I hadn't made it into the elite colleges that my private Catholic high school peers had prepared their whole lives for. I spent junior year grieving my best friend's death in a car accident and hit my snare drum more than I did the books. Playing music was my solace, and college felt as vague as any other recognizable purpose for my life. I relied on sensory pleasure to direct me into the workforce. Maybe that same sensory instinct and an inkling that such feelings were linked to class, identity, difference, and belonging shaped my rides along the 704 route. I wasn't the only bus commuter in the office, where my colleagues were transplants from the East Coast and Midwest, still struggling to crack Greater LA's transportation codes, still aghast at the ways Angeleños navigate distance. They eventually put down payments on the first wave of Priuses. But as an LA native, I rode the bus to read Roque Dalton's poetry and to attempt my own imitations. And as I crossed the zip codes and views transformed from murals depicting the Mesoamerican ancestors of many of my neighbors to the architecturally promiscuous porticos of Beverly Hills, I chatted with middle-aged mothers on their way to manage other people's homes and children. A jolt of familiarity, since my own mother had done this too, as a young woman, just a few years before I was born. I remember someone a few years older than me who asked if my husband let me work. I wish I could credit the woman who explained what huitlacoche is, the edible corn fungus some liken to a truffle. But most of the conversations ended with both parties awkwardly aware of a divide. I was born in Los Angeles to parents who, due to their own luck, or lack of it, in arriving in the early 1970s, had become U.S. citizens under Ronald Reagan's Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, which had extended amnesty to those who entered the country illegally prior to 1982. My father had come from Mexico, from the capital city of the state of Hidalgo, to harvest potatoes in Wisconsin and lettuce in Watsonville, south of Santa Cruz. In 1970, after 2 years in the Golden State, he was unceremoniously returned, via bus ride, to El Paso, where he was left to walk the bridge into Ciudad Juarez. He quickly devised a plan to return, and this time found relief in the anonymity of Los Angeles. He experienced the harder knocks of moving north to a country that wants your labor, but not your personhood. Whereas my mother arrived by plane and found her own path to a 704 stop near the nexus of San Vicente, Wilshire, and Santa Monica Boulevards, where the Bermuda Triangle of Beverly Hills swallows its Latinx labor force. Eventually, she overstayed her visa. But both my parents received amnesty, and while my father went back and forth in political party affiliations, my mother voted Republican for the next 3 decades in homage to Reagan's life-changing policy, despite his interventionism against her country of origin, El Salvador. I often think of my parents as having been among thousands of similar erasures, those excluded from the functional successes of the city until they reached middle age. I think, too, about how the economic security they did at last achieve allowed me to stumble into my own politics. My mother had time to take my sister and me to the library in Huntington Park to practice her English with every verse she read aloud from the worn copy of children's Bible stories she kept on the nightstand in the pink-painted bedroom my sister and I shared. I persist. 20 years later, in this queer midlife, in never having found an occasion to use the word Latinx around her, or around my father, who died last year. This in spite of the fact, in other realms, I traffic in the complicated nuances of the term, its representational burden meant to index history and create safety for those whose gender is considered nonconforming. There was a point on my bus ride where, from the group of us starting at the same destination, only I was left. I headed west to Santa Monica, into my own erasures.
That was writer and educator Raquel Gutierrez reading the first section of their personal essay called A Concatenation of Sprawls. You can read the entire piece, which dives into the spaces built by and for the Latinx queer community here in L.A., in Places Journal. We'll have a link to it at kcrw.com/greaterLA. plus an opportunity for you to share your own personal essays about Los Angeles. That's at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Halloween is just a couple of weeks away, so appropriately there's an art exhibit going on at a couple of museums titled Witch Hunt. But it's not what you think. It's actually a creative cauldron of more than a dozen feminist artists from around the globe on display at the Hammer Museum near UCLA and at the Institute of Contemporary Art LA in downtown's Arts District. And they have a specific purpose in mind. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, is founder and editor-in-chief of Carla, Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. She went to check them out, and she's here to talk about it. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
All Halloween puns aside, by the way, tell us what's behind the exhibition and its title, Witch Hunt.
Right. So the curators of the show, which are Connie Butler from the Hammer Museum and Anne Elgood from the ICA LA, they say that the show began with this very simple yet complex question, which is, what does it mean to be feminist in the age of Donald Trump? Right. So, of course, Trump is no longer president, but this exhibition, Witch Hunt, has been in the works since 2016, which, as a lot of us remember, was the year that Trump got elected. So, you know, this show is really, the title is kind of coming from this reclaiming of a phrase that Trump tweeted actually 350 times throughout his presidency, witch hunt. And he kind of co-opted that term that historically has been used to bring harm to women and co-opted it to kind of turn himself into the victim. So I think in a lot of ways, the show starts with this kind of rage that Trump elicited in many of us. And the curators wanted to really use that as a starting point. And they talk about wanting the show to kind of nurture outrage as a productive tool towards change. So really celebrating this kind of like gendered rage. The show really unpacks a lot of systems of gender, power, and patriarchy and sort of uses that as a starting place.
So not only does the exhibition feature 16 artists, but there are a lot of media included here as well, painting and sculpture and video, even sound and performance. Describe the overall theme. I mean, what are we talking about here? What's going on with this entire work as a whole?
Yeah, and I will say the curators did a really nice job of giving each artist their own space to really create an installation. So you kind of feel like you're walking into each project one at a time. But the work, you know, it ranges a lot, like you said, through different mediums and represents artists from 13 countries. So there's a lot of different perspectives in the mix here. But I think, again, all of them are really using their artwork, whatever the medium, to really explore a kind of feminist, queer, or decolonial strategy. Again, that idea of resistance. So a lot of these projects are very different in the strategies that they use, but they feel really united in kind of reimagining a more utopian future and really celebrating a female perspective. Again, this is an international group of artists, so they're all responding to various political conditions. But resistance is really at the core. And each of these artists have this kind of boldness within their artwork to be heard and kind of explore the nuances and how we think about gender. So within that, of course, there's a lot of different themes that the work can take. So some of the work has to do with women's rights, representation. Some of it has to do with the female body or erasure of women throughout history. And some look really broadly at ecology or climate change, surveillance. And so a lot of these very kind of political ideas that are broader and kind of span gender. I think for all of these artists, they're really channeling these ideas through their artwork and asking, what does it mean for an art object to become a tool or a conduit for resistance?
So this exhibition, Lindsay, as I mentioned at the top, it's split into a couple of installations. 11 of the artists are at the Hammer. 5 of them are at ICA LA. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, so actually one of the co-curators, Anne Elgood, used to be a curator at The Hammer and was at The Hammer when the exhibition was kind of in its early planning stages. So in 2019, Anne became the director over at the ICALA. But of course, you know, this exhibition was already underway and they really wanted to see it through. And I should note that the ICA's curator, Jamila James, also used to work at The Hammer. So there's a lot of camaraderie between these two institutions. They're both really committed to contemporary art and obviously share some of the same previous staff. So I think they just wanted to have this exhibition unite their two institutions.
Well, Witch Hunt is on at The Hammer and at ICALA through January 9th. So it's not just Halloween season. It goes all the way through the beginning of the year. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, our art insider and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
And that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow in this slot, a special radio episode of KCRW's podcast Bodies. We're going to be back on Monday, and next week an update on the slow supply chain. Things are opening up more. You're hearing news about that today. That is good, but it's been quite the slog at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach. Catherine Burns, Jackie Sudley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help piece the show together tonight. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ear. Have a great night.